Welcome to Minds Under Matters 2.0. I haven't recorded it yet, but you guys will have heard a solo episode kind of explaining some of the future of the show and incorporating some new guests and artists, as well as having Ramin do special surprise pop-ins and stuff like that as we continue to collaborate together. And a mutual friend of both of ours, about my oldest friend in comedy that I still keep up with, is joining us, Mike Kaplan.
Hey, happy to be here as guest Ramin. I'm really good at drawing, but also I'm good at impressions. And also I play music. So happy to be here. Gotta go right now. Can't be here right now.
We have this idea of, I have a few different. So I have this Vegas residency show that I'm working on as part of why we've been busy and on a break for a couple months, and Ramin and I are working on certain aspects of that together, and I'm collaborating with some artists because there's going to be some like visual art and some animation and stuff added to the stand-up, and super cool stuff that I'm really looking forward to. And I was just thinking, this is actually our editor, Matt McCool, came up with the idea of what if each of our guests makes the piece of art for the episode in whatever capacity that they're able to. I haven't decided if I like that idea or not. I might do that and also like put it, we have a ton of artists in our community on our Discord and stuff, so I think it's going to be a little more community driven, but it's also kind of a funny idea to like,
I feel like that's a good idea. That's like the net to like, hey, do you want to like, each guest, would you like to walk out on a tightrope for a little while? Don't worry, if you fall and die, we do have some other acrobats ready to do amazing things. They'll catch you and throw you off screen and take over from there.
I didn't even know this until a couple hours before us recording, but the time we're going to be releasing this is a Valentine's Day episode, and you are one of the best people to talk about love with. You are very good at sharing and expressing love and writing people notes and emails and texts all the time and keeping up with so many people. And I remember I wrote you something at the end of the year saying how it's always been inspirational to me, and I wish that I had I wish I was more mindful and disciplined in doing things like that. If you're friends with Mike Kaplan, you get like a monthly newsletter, sometimes promoting some stuff, but also mostly just like appreciation of friendship and being in one another's life. That's fun.
Celebrating being alive for another month or so, or however long it's been. And wasn't always like this. You know, I feel like it's sometime in the past, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, I started, I'd be at the airport or something and, you know, waiting to get on a flight. And I'm like, oh, who haven't I texted in a while? And I just go through my texts and be like, I haven't talked to, and like, we have the technology. It's very, I have technology helps me do it as well. Like, I keep lists of people that I want to be in touch with. My phone does it. My computer does it. You know, it's all like, it's so much easier than, you know, hundreds of years ago. You had to be very meticulous with, you know, a quill. And now, but originally I just started reaching out to people and telling them that I cared about them. And the original, most people, a lot of people, not everyone, some people were like, thank you, and I feel the same way. And some people were like, what is the meaning of this? Are you you dying? Or I don't understand exactly how to receive this affection that you're expressing. There must be, if you're dying, I get it, absolutely. But you're just, I'm like, well, I'm dying like the regular amount, I think, you know, where every moment, a moment closer to the surprise.
So. Yeah. I actually, I actually, this is really, so Mike and I used to write together when we started in comedy. We would have writing meetings, we would get other new comics together and write jokes and stuff. And I thought about you recently. Actually, I'm going to just grab this. One second.
I'll tell people about those writing meetings. Like Shane would be like, hey, so I have an idea about a butt. And I would be like, can you make it about two butts? Yeah. What about three butts? And Shane would be like, yes, three butts is what that joke should be about. Okay, Shane's back.
It's always three butts is so much better. That really was early Shane. It's funny that you say that because I have a new real science-y anus joke that I'm working on. So there's like, so I'm just writing more sophisticated versions of what is at my core, which is always of obsession, fascination, and disgust with buttholes that I cannot get over.
You know, it's funny that you say that. Our mutual friend, our dear friend, Zach Sherwin, yes, has wonderful songs. And yes, one of them, I don't know if you've seen the video. If everyone out there, watch the video for Drop Bars. The song Drop Bars, mm-hmm, basically is about his, he's like, he writes a clever thing and then through each successive verse discusses and disclaims how he has grown from being the kind of person that wrote that clever thing with more and more self-awareness until eventually in a chop wood, carry water, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water, after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. At the end of it, he's basically like, well, no matter how advanced I get, I'm always going to be me. So here's like the final, like, ultimate version of me, which is really the same as the original me. And so I feel like you are the same, but for butts. And like, you started with butts, you end with the alpha and the omega. I mean, they talk about the butt is the end, and the end could be the beginning end or the other end. There's two ends of a thing. There's not even a beginning. Like, so I'm excited for, and you're at the Venn diagram overlap of science and butts. I think, no, can't name any other comedian.
I was once, this is really a real conversation that I had with my manager in like 2011, 2012. I was like, I think I'm going to release a double album. One album is all of the smartest jokes that I have, and then the other album is all butthole material. Just nothing but butthole material.
I mean, I love that idea. That what an amazing, I think it's not too late.
I know. Well, this is all being tied together in such amazing. So speaking of gratitude, so the show that I'm working, so I did a tour, 111 City Psychedelic Tour, a good trip. It became a documentary, Psychonautics. It was it like inspired a bunch of things, got me on like these Comedy Central Tales from the Trip things. And sometimes I'm apprehensive about how much I want my life and work to be dedicated toward the psychedelic space, and I care more about, it's like buttholes, it's like, yeah, I like writing it, but I also want to have this other side of me. I want to have the double album. And and so through a series of, basically there's constraints because I'm working with artists, and a really easy way to do it is just to send them a recording of the old show to be like, hey, do you have any like easy accessible things that spring readily to mind? Start with the art first, and then I can reconstruct the show from there. The art's the hard part for me. Writing the jokes, putting the material together is easy. And so we decided, and with talking with them, Area 15 is like this very trippy, like Meow Wolf is this big 250 person artist collective that started in Santa Fe, and this Area 15 is part of that expansion into Vegas, and they're starting in outside Dallas now and Oklahoma City, and getting these huge immersive, they have a big one in Denver. And in talking, we thought we should just call this a better trip because we still have we still have the same material, or I mean, we still have like the recognizability of like Ramin's poster and everything with a slightly different look from me. And then also I've had some issues with psychedelics since a good trip and found out that like, I don't necessarily believe that there's no such thing as a bad trip and that there are only difficult ones. I think there are bad trips. And the idea being some of the premise being, what have I learned to make the psychedelic experience itself better, but also what have I learned from psychedelics to make this journey through existence better, and have
that,
a better trip.
That is connected, I feel like, to, you know, have you heard, I think I heard Pete Holmes say once that he heard maybe Ram Dass or Alan Watts or someone, you know, those guys say like, if you're doing psychedelics, he's like, once you get the message, you can hang up the phone. Mm-hmm. So it is another kind of chop wood, carry water thing. Like, you're not meditating to become the best meditator. You're not doing psychedelics to become the best psychedelic doer. You're doing, hopefully, everything to become, you know, to live the richest, fullest, deepest life that you can, which at some point might involve being like, I think I might have done enough psychedelics.
I've taken some breaks here and there. I did just do a bunch of ketamine last night, so I'm back in business. But but that's an easier one for me. Duncan Trussell has some joke that I don't remember, but the premise is explaining that if you get the message, hang up the phone, and like, what kind of an asshole friend just does that? Like, oh, you just gave me the most important information in my life. All right, thanks. Never talking to you again. click.
That is funny. And I think it depends what the message is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if the message is, hang up the phone. I'll keep talking to you.
I've gotten some of those. I bet you have as well, with like ayahuasca or whatever. But I've definitely gotten some with DMT where it's like, what are you doing back here? Like, this is, you haven't done the things from the last time. What happened to that? Like,
that's funny. You know, on the other end of things, I met some kids, like some college kids that I was on their podcast years ago. And so, you know, between 18 and 21, and we're talking about, you know, I didn't smoke pot until I was in my 20s. I didn't do mushrooms until my 20s, ayahuasca till my 30s. And they're, you know, 19 and had done mushrooms, one of them told me he had done DMT when he was like 15. And I was like, what was that like? And he's like, it told me I wasn't ready for it. It was like a magic eight ball, like, ask again later, maybe.
That's funny. Wow.
It's like, how did you even reach the phone? Did you stand on like several phone books to even make this call? Are you using your father's credit card to call the all here? Like, go back to school, kid.
So I make a very important point about this very thing at the end of my Good Trip show, and at the end of the Psychonautics documentary and everything. But I think I wanted to start with something that lays that down as the premise for the show, which is that all of this existence is very bizarre and trippy, and we just kind of become complacent with, we just get used to it and take it for granted, essentially. And in doing so, I had this guest, Henry G. He's an editor at Nature. He's this wonderful, articulate, super humorous, very poetic science writer. And he wrote this book, A Very Short History of Life on Earth. Something like 4.6 billion years of life and 12 pithy chapters or something. And it's a pretty small, it's one of the better books I've ever read. It's very accessible. Could I just read you the beginning of it?
I wish you would.
It's beautiful. Ramin would always say that I'm the second worst reader in the world. dyslexia. Okay. So once upon a time, a giant star was dying. It had been burning for millions of years. Now the fusion furnace at its core had no more fuel to burn. The star created the energy it needed to shine by fusing hydrogen atoms to make helium. The energy produced by the fusion did more than make the star shine. It was vital to counteract the inward pull of the star's own gravity. When the supply of available hydrogen began to run low, the star began to fuse helium into atoms of heavier elements such as carbon and oxygen. By then, though, the star was running out of things to burn. The day came when the fuel ran out completely. Gravity won the battle. The star imploded. After millions of years of burning, the collapse took a split second. It prompted a rebound so explosive that it lit up the universe, a supernova. Any life that might have existed in the star's own planetary system would have been obliterated. But in the cataclysm of its death were born the seeds of something new, and even heavier chemical elements forged in the final moments of the star's life. Silicon, nickel, sulfur, and iron were spread far and wide by the explosion. Millions of years later, the gravitational shockwave of the supernova explosion passed through a cloud of gas, dust, and ice. The stretch and squeeze of the gravitational wave made the cloud fall in on itself. As it contracted, it started to rotate. The pull of gravity squeezed the gas at the cloud's center so much that the atoms began to fuse together. Hydrogen atoms were pressed together, forming helium, creating light and heat. The circle of stellar life was complete. From the death of an ancient star emerged another fresh and new, our sun.
Happy Valentine's
Day. Happy Valentine's Day. Isn't that
That's
lovely?
That's beautiful. Oh, yeah. Everything, it's like, I guess everything is like, you know, beautiful shrapnel, you know, coming from some explosion.
One of the cool things the book does is talk about the many mass extinctions that led to the inventiveness of life over and over again. Well, five mass extinctions, to be exact, but and future ones forthcoming. So I have this idea of kind of starting the show with a like summary of how we got to be here in a fun way, with ending with something like, anyway, the point is, like, if you eat mushrooms and go to a science museum, things will really stick with you. And there's an aspect in there that I thought you'd appreciate given our conversation, which is, so when life first evolved, there was speculative, but probably like little bubbles in like cracks deep in the ocean, in a very turbulent space. Just the right amount of like elements and energy was able to collect and use those bubbles as membranes that would then replicate. And they started, and they'd be, you know, microscopic, and figured out how to replicate. And then over time, so energy would be absorbed through this membrane, and then waste would diffuse through this membrane. And then over time, things like sponges and stuff would have like these slits that would diffuse waste. And then these little things eventually had like an opening that became a mouth, and also the waste would go out the same place. And it was just this round, like stationary thing with like a little opening. And then one day something stumbled on an anus and it changed everything. Life had a direction. It became forward facing. The way that the pellets came out from it afterwards created all of the conditions to create oxygen and all of these things in the water column in the ocean. And from that, those old things that were used to diffuse waste before eventually got co-opted as fish gills, and it gave the ability to breathe for larger things underwater. And then once things got on land, those gills slowly moved back and became our ears. And all of this stuff just would not have happened if it weren't for the anus.
If not for the anus, there wouldn't be an us.
That's fun.
That's amazing. It sounds like, you know, I don't know if you've ever read, you know,
sorry to interrupt. But There's a few points that he makes in this book. One is how important mass extinction was for diversity. Two is the Triassic period is greatly neglected. Everyone focuses on the end and just the dinosaurs, but there's the way cooler stuff before that. And three, just how important the anus was. And you can imagine my delight as I'm reading this book, not knowing that that's where it was going.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people think of it as just like the butthole, but it's really so much more. It's a butt. Hole. It's a W-H-O-L-E. All I was going to say is like that the story of, you know, the scientific evolution of life on Earth stemming from the manifestation of the anus. It really sounds like myths and legends from like, you know, native peoples that are like, and then this god cries and their tears became this group of people and they bled and the blood became these animals. And then out of their anuses came these mountains, you know, the rivers, the fish. But you're like, no, that's what it was.
That's what happened. Just took millions of years. It wasn't in a split moment.
Oh yeah. Do you know what is cool about, I learned about hippos some years ago. Ooh, there's a couple cool things about hippos. The butt stuff that's relevant is you don't want to stand behind any animal when it's doing its butt pooping, but specifically you want to most avoid a hippo because they like swing their tail while they're doing it in order to make sure nobody's like, I guess, sneaking up behind them. that's one of their defense mechanisms. And they also, they sweat a substance that acts as sunscreen is another cool thing.
Wow.
I'm like, why don't we do that? Intelligent designers.
Rhinos. I was once at the Dallas-Fort Worth Zoo. I've gone and got to interview people at zoos before and got to go behind the scenes and stuff and real fun experience. And one of those times I was seeing the rhinos behind the scenes and
they have their costumes off, their heads off, they're just smoking. Being like, when are the kids coming back?
And I was hanging out with this baby rhino and it's saying hi and everything. And then we go to talk to its parents in another area, and the baby was jealous of the attention and then sprayed urine up like 30 feet in the air like a fire hose. And so a rhinoceros can, if you got hit with the rhinoceros urine, like it would be like a shotgun.
Wow.
Yeah. Life is so absolutely strange.
Yeah, we talk a lot about gun control, which is important, but not as much about bladder control. Rhino bladder control in particular. Yeah.
So let's see. I want to get into love, but I wonder, should we give people a little bit of our history, how we first met? We met in Boston doing stand up.
Sure. I remember, I think the first time I saw you was at the Emerald Isle on the open mic that happened every Wednesday, I believe. I had just started doing comedy maybe around that time, 2002-ish, and give or take. And I remember seeing you, and the way that I would tell it to be poetic is from from the second time I saw you, I thought, this guy is a genius who's going places. And the first time I saw you, I was like, this is gross. Oh, yeah, it was, I was like, why are you letting things come out of your mouth about things coming out of everyone's bodies? And don't you want to keep everything inside yourself about how everyone doesn't keep things inside themselves?
I think I had such a, I think I had such a like prim and proper kind of wholesome Midwestern upbringing that just like I did never fit in with and just drove me out of my mind, and just like lots of judgment and lots of caution around what things were said. So the moment I was given a platform to say all of the things, it's just like, cummy diarrhea.
And just for anyone who couldn't tell I think you enunciated pretty well, but that was diarrhea that is like cummy, not come eat diarrhea. But that either way,
gross.
Yeah. I mean, that makes complete sense. I remember, have you heard of this book, Summerhill?
No.
There was a school in England, I believe, like maybe in the 60s and 70s. I don't think it's there anymore, but it was basically founded under the idea that they'd rather graduate happy street cleaners than neurotic lawyers, was the way that they put it. And so you didn't have to go to any particular classes. You just, if you're like, I want to be a doctor, then they'd be like, well, then to get into medical school, you'll need to know this science and you'll need to know this math. But you don't have to, but if you want to. And so because it was motivated by them, by the child themselves, they didn't feel like they were being made to do things that they didn't want to do. They were only taking the classes they wanted. Some kids hung out in like the wood shop all day and then did that for their life because that's what they were drawn to. And that complete freedom, my understanding is sometimes if older children, if you started at that school, then you were kind of like good to go from the beginning. But if you came to the school later, you know, like when you were, I don't know, 9, 10, 11 or whatever, and you're like, I can do anything. Yeah. They like kids just start throwing bricks through windows and it's not that there weren't any consequences, but it wasn't, they weren't shamed. They were just like, oh yeah, of course. When you were held back, you were going to, like, you know that thing, you ever put your stand in a doorway and you press your wrists against the door. Yeah. And then when you come out of the doorway, your arms float because you've been restraining them. And that's what happens to a child at that school. And and you, free from the conservative Midwestern upbringing, you're I can let any kind of diarrhea butt joke fly.
This connects really well because I have feelings of, I loved stand up passionately and you remember we would have so many conversations about the art and the craft of stand up and oh my gosh, like I look back, it is just like, I was like very rigid and dogmatic in that way in my thinking, like a art purist sort of way. It's funny that like with my all my butthole jokes, I was still like, but I'm a purist. and it's, yeah, I want to talk about love and then what it's like to, because I feel like I have there's been times that have, I think you'll relate to this, maybe not in comedy, but in other aspects, where I've fallen out of love where I've had this passion that I've been in love with and I've fallen out of love with it. And then, but I'm still like connected to it. And then there's ways of, I've like reinvented myself over and over again, simply because I just figure something out and get some sense of feeling like I have a mastery over it, or not that I do, but just like, this is like, I don't need to be any better at this than I am. And like, I just don't care enough anymore. And It's been something. It's been a little hard for me to like get back into stand up too until like very, very recently I started writing again and care because I've enjoyed putting together the show and putting together a festival and producing. Like my passion's just gone elsewhere. So I would love if you could share just some thoughts on love generally, and then maybe us connect it to whatever humanity, friendship, careers, that sort of thing.
Sure. So, I mean, just sort of piggybacking off of what you just said, I would say when I was, my parents were both music teachers. And so I started playing the violin when I was 4, and I did not like it because I was made to do it. Mm-hmm. Like that school Summer Hill. I eventually ended up at a summer camp that was founded by a man and his wife, and the man had studied with Maria Montessori, who also... you know, it was like children don't like to be taught. They like to learn. You know, you like to be as much as possible self-motivated rather than like these are the rules. Discover for yourself what you love to do, what you love to spend your time with. And so my mom, you know, specifically wanted me to love music. And I didn't immediately because I was being made to do it. Like I had to take, I went every week. I had to go like for hours a day to this, to school on Saturdays, like half of my weekend spent playing in an orchestra and taking theory lessons and playing in a quartet and having a private lesson another day of the week. And eventually there was like sometimes like 3 days a week where after school and on the weekend I was being made to do this music. And I eventually, when I was in high school and when I was at this summer camp, I discovered the guitar, and a friend of mine played the guitar, and I picked up his guitar, and I was just kind of like noodling around, and I'm like, oh, this is fun. It's fun to like pluck a string and make a sound and move my fingers and do this thing. And like eventually having the experience, you know, of loving music that my mom wanted me to have, but I'm like, but I'm doing it on my terms with the guitar. And there's this story that I like thinking about from a Yiddish folk writer, Isaac Besheva Singer, who I read his stories as a child. I was shared. My grandfather read, like, had a book of his stories. And there's one story about this stupid town of called Chelm, this European town, Chelm. And the idea was everybody there was dumb, and the elders of the town were the dumbest. Anyway, there was this dumb guy from there who goes out into the world, and he like stops at a restaurant and he orders some food. And they bring him the food and he's not full. And he orders more food and he keeps ordering food. He orders like almost everything on the menu. And eventually they bring him a cookie and he eats the cookie and he's like, okay, now I'm full. And he's like, if only I had known that it was the cookie that would make me full, I wouldn't have had to order all that other stuff. I could have just jumped right to the end, give me the full making cookie, please. And we're like, what a fool that foolish man is. And yet... here I was at age 15 being like, I love the guitar. Man, if only I had started playing the guitar when I was 4, I didn't have to waste all that time on the violin learning all that stuff I didn't want to learn. Imagine how much I'd love the guitar, how good I'd get at the guitar. And so I remember telling my mom about this this line I love from The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. And the line is, The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. And I was like, all that sorrow that was carved into me from those violin lessons that I hated eventually made way for the joy to fill all that space with the guitar, writing songs that I love. And my mom was like, you were suffering? There was sorrow? And I was like, but I'm happy now. She's like, I feel very bad. But so I feel like that is what led me to... that was my original career dream at age 15, 16. Like I played some funny songs, some not funny songs, or some maybe all funny songs, but only some intended to be funny because I just loved playing, you know. And then I went to college and I kept doing that. And that's what searching for places to play helped me find the comedy studio, like pre-Google, you know, on some Ask Jeeves or, you know, whatever, late 90s.
I looked in the yellow pages when I got to Boston in 2003 and my first set at the studio. And when you met me at the Emerald Isle, it was 2004. And I looked in the yellow pages and found the studio, and Rick Jenkins happened to live, my place was on his walk to the comedy studio, and he dropped off a packet of helpful information for new comics.
That's really cool. When I started going there, there wasn't even a packet yet. I think they were still, I called up. I just called the number and Rick, the owner and only person that worked there at the time, answered. And I was like, I play some funny songs. Can I play them at your building? And he's like, sure, you can have 5 minutes, you know? And yeah. Then I truly fell in love with stand-up. Like my first time on stage, not even trying to do stand-up, just playing two songs and talking in between them and people laughing at the talking, which I now would call riffing. But then I called talking until they stopped laughing. And I just loved that I didn't even need anything. I didn't need outside of myself to have this, you know, communion with the audience. And when people ask me, like, when did you know you wanted to do comedy? I'm like, well, it's a little bit after I started doing comedy that I knew I wanted to, because I didn't even intend to be doing it. So it was, you know, kind of like with any love advice where they're like, you know, you got to love yourself first. You know, it's when you stop looking, it's when you're, you know, just caring for yourself and, you know, doing what you think feels, you know, right and healthy. And, you know, there's all kinds of things people say, and I'm sure that some of them work for some people and not for others. But at the time, I would say that, yeah, that was like, I mean, I fell in love with comedy in a way that I would sometimes call like an open relationship with art, you know, the way that my original love was music. But then I eventually like was like, well, I think I'm going to spend more time dating comedy and eventually marrying comedy. And comedy's not jealous. It's like, if you want to make music, that's fine, too. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you were saying as well with, you know, for a while you're not doing stand up, but you're never stopping being creative, you know, whether you're creating a festival, creating a podcast, creating, you know, just some joy and meaning in your life with your friends. Like I think there's certainly not a zero sum game. And I feel like it just gets more and more like when I was in college, when I decided that I wanted to pursue music, I cut out a lot of other activities because I had like five things that I'm like, do I want to be a teacher? Do I want to like study math? Do I want to go to grad school for psychology? Do I want to, you know, I was going in all these different directions. Do I want to be in this a cappella group, which I was in? And I felt like I was stuck because I was being pulled in a lot of directions. And I'm like, all I have to do is like let go of one or two things and then, you know, launch in whatever direction I feel like I want to head in. And I feel like, you know, love of a human being, like romantic love, like sort of worked like that for me also, in that I, you know, 7 years ago, very grateful to have met Rini, my partner of these last almost 7 years. And she's a person who, like, you know, before I was with her, I was an open relationship person. I was, you know, I had been married monogamously and I was like, well, that doesn't seem to be the right answer, I don't think, at 25. But I was like, I think it's monogamy. That's the thing that doesn't work for me. And, you know, there are so many people for whom if you want it and you make it work, great. And if you don't want it and you make it not work, great. But I now that I've, you know, I've met this person and I'm like, I love spending time with this person. And I feel like any time that I'm not spending with her, like right now I'm in here and she's in the other room and I'm like, I mean, we should finish this podcast soon so I can go spend more time with my person I love. But also, of course, I feel like for me, the desire to have like open romantic relationships has sort of like alchemized or transubstantiated into, you know, something that's been there all along, which is like platonic relationships, you know, that I do. There's you and there's Zach and there's Ramin and there's like so many, you know, wonderful, beautiful people in the world and in my life that I'm so grateful, like, and honored and delighted to have gotten to know, you know, and like even for some of them, like, I feel like it is like there's like an analogy to the dating world, like to the romantic dating world and like the comedic artistic world, that, you know, you're putting yourself out there. You're opening yourself up to rejection. Like when I met Ramin because, like, you know, 10 or so years ago, he did the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, and I watched it and I wrote to, you know, I found him online and I wrote him and I said, "Hey, man, that was a really funny set you did on TV." And he was like, "Oh, I saw you on TV once. you did a funny set." And then we were friends. And, you know, like, you and I, you know, we met the old fashioned way in person at an open mic. But today there's all these apps. You can meet people on Snapchat. You can meet people on TikTok. But, like, and, you know, talking about meeting people and discovering, like, there's so many people creating hilarious comedy, beautiful art, you know, for all the comedians that are like, "You can't say anything these days." I'm like, well, there's a lot of people saying a lot of things. So I'm like super excited to hear what everyone else, like, I love.
Also, you're just also saying you can't say anything on top of the thing that you're saying you can't say.
Oh, yeah. Whenever people say you can't say anything, I'm like, how did you say that? It's a miracle. Are you putting it in my brain directly? I'm a psychic. But yeah, it's so that's those are some initial thoughts on love. I'll leave to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think that I've probably explored this on the show in the past, but I feel like there was nothing that I loved more than stand-up comedy. I watched every bit of it that I could since the age of like 10 years old, and it's so, you know, the second time that you saw me, I also had like 12 years of dreaming and watching stand up constantly and taking notes and writing things and stuff, and just had the stage fright to get over. There's this idea, I think Steven Pinker talks about in How the Mind Works, this idea of love being this emotional contract. So hunter-gatherers before lawyers and things like that. Any of our emotions are these kind of honest indicators, these social contracts, whether it's like you completely withdraw and are depressed or whatever. This is like a real indicator of like you're bargaining for like, I'm not being treated fairly, or this is not worth my commitment to the group or whatever, which is also fucked up because now we're not in a tribe. We're just alone by ourselves without people to signal that to, and still those same mechanisms. And then it's not being received by anyone. So probably making it worse and worse, but besides the point. The same as with like anger, and, you know, someone, the crazy guy in the bar that flips, like that might not be who they are as a whole, or that might be out of character for them. But in that moment, it's a very honest social contract that like this person might really actually fight, you know, and love being the same sort of thing of like there are always these, if we had this kind of robotic analytical, I'm going to constantly be on the lookout for the highest ranking mate to pass my genes on to raise my children or whatever, there would always like maybe be someone else out there that you could be like, ooh, I could jump over there and there's a better mate, and there would have been things that evolved to like, well, the cost of that and starting over and everything would have been so costly that evolving this kind of love thing that keeps you to like, no matter what happens beyond all logic, you stay bonded to this thing. And I feel like I had that with comedy for a long time until it became this full-time thing. And then it was more like a marriage, where now I'm in a comedy club, you know what my editor Matt McCool, he said on the phone like within this like last 2 months of all this like drama and everything else and various like huge awesome possibilities, things like this Vegas residency and stuff like that, and like just really high stakes things happening, high consequence things happening, and he just goes, I've never met anyone with such a tolerance for risk in my entire life. And I used to be like that on stage. Like, I didn't care about the, like, I liked making the comics in the back of the room laugh. I liked it. I was not afraid to alienate an audience. I liked playing with that tension. And then once you're like, well, now my income is completely dependent on this. Now a comedy club is looking at comment cards or giving me a talk afterwards or like looking at me weird if the show didn't go as well. It just like, it just changed everything. And it was less love, more like a prison over time. And it's not... It's not that it was like, you know, it was a dream job and everything, but there were just like things that came along with it that made me lose some of that passion. And there has to be stuff with like, you know, getting married that can be similar where it's like, you do want to spend the rest of your life with this person that is genuine. And then you like commit to it on paper and then you go like, oh, well now I don't actually even have a choice. And now and it just like kind of changes your relationship to that connection.
It sure can. I mean, in my situation, thankfully, I'm the exception because my girlfriend is the best. I think I met all the people.
She is great.
I have a new hour of comedy that she has co-created with me, in which like that part of it is I tell each audience that they're the last people that I hadn't met and none of them are better than my girlfriend. And so if you think that you are happy with your partner, then I'm happy for you. But of course, if you haven't met my girlfriend, then you don't know that you haven't met the best person. But also, I had a similar experience like that with respect to the summer camp that I was talking about. Like when I was a teenager, you know, from when I was 11, I went there every summer, all summer. And that's where I like became who I was and like helped me come out of my shell and blossom like a beautiful turtle flower. And then like these, I was surrounded by other creative people and started like, you know, making some lifelong friendships with people who are still my dear friends from there today. And like, I thought I'll never not want to come back here. I'll never like, you know, 15, 16, 17, and I became a counselor and eventually, and I taught music there and I taught stand-up workshops and I don't go back full summer all the time now. I do like occasionally go and, you know, teach some workshops, but I remember when I became an adult, like being there shifted in a way that I wasn't just there to like, I don't know if it's Picasso or somebody who said like the first half of your life is dedicated to discovering your gift and the second half is dedicated to giving it away, you know? And so being there as a teacher and like helping create that environment for other kids so that it wasn't just like for me, like, so, you know, for a comedian, it might be like in the beginning, you're like, me, 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 I'm doing what's good for me and the other comedians. Then eventually you're like, also, I suppose I'm going to be thinking about, you know, the people receiving it, whether it be the audiences and the owners of clubs who are bringing me back, et cetera. And then also, there's an idea that love isn't necessarily an emotion by definition. Like, love could be like a verb, an action, a choice. That, like, when you love someone, it doesn't just mean that you all the time are, you know, having butterflies floating around your head. That, you know, that that's not the new relationship energy that lasts your whole life. You know, that doesn't happen. That, you know, in the first 9 months, 18 months of a relationship, biologically, evolutionarily, you know, we feel those chemicals because, you know, sex wants us to keep making more of the species. And then after that point, they're like, well, now you can go on to the next. And but love, you know, in the modern, you know, in our sort of paradigm, we're like, love can be choosing to continue to be with someone and build a life with them that then you get deeper enriching enjoyment out of that aren't the same as, you know, the first falling in, like falling in love and being in love is like maybe as different as like running for office and being in office. Mm-hmm. And that it reminds me also of the Buddhist definition of love that I like a lot, or a definition is that they say love, when you love someone, you desire for their happiness to increase. And when you're compassionate for someone, when you have compassion, that means you desire their suffering to decrease. And that's everything. You just want, you know, and that we all want happiness to increase and suffering to decrease, certainly for ourselves and for our loved ones and for, you know, all sentient beings, as many as you can, you know, hold within your consciousness. And I'm also just real quick reminded of Thich Nhat Hanh, the, you know, wonderful Buddhist monk. He says a thing about happiness that he says there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. And so I feel like that is why, like, in a similar way, you know, if I have a night of shows where one of them isn't my favorite, like I'm not like, oh no, like, did I make a mistake with my life committing to do this job, to be this comedian, to have this be, you know, what, like, why, you know, where some people they're like, man, if I have a bad set, I'm like, why didn't I just stay home and do something else? Like write a script. And I'm like, well, then do that if you want to do that. Yeah. Like, I talked to a writer once, a friend who does some stand up, but is mainly a writer. And he's like, anytime I have a bad set, I'm like, I could have stayed home and written 10 pages and that would have been more valuable. And I'm like, would the 10 pages guaranteed have been good? And he was like, no, absolutely not. And I'm like, well, then that's your show that doesn't go well, that you're committed to, that you love, even when it doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. What have you done to... how would you say that your stand-up has evolved over time, and just your style, but also your relationship to it?
Sure. I mean, stylistically, I would say I started out like very written, you know, very like short snippets. Like I remember thinking about like you and me when we started, it was much like polar opposites, that like if I was going to end up with 5 minutes of material, I was going to start with, you know, 1,000 one line things that are 10 seconds each, and then like add those up, you know, combine them like snowflakes into a snowball that was as compact as possible. Whereas you were starting with just like a blizzard, flurries of like an hour of material that you're like chop, 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 chop. Eventually, here's the 5 minutes that is.
Yeah.
And I have a little more like the people that really inspired me to the first shift in how I do things were Rory Scovel and Micah Sherman.
Rory Scovel almost made me quit comedy. Like I saw him at this Atlanta Comedy Festival in I think 2019 or something like that, and I felt like I was like in a pretty good place with what I was doing. I was happy with what I was doing. I did like my good trip show and had a good time. And then he had a show afterwards, and
it was dedicated to how you should quit doing comedy, and it was improvised and brilliant. And you're like, these are a lot of good points.
It was completely improvised. It was like, and I don't like improvised comedy a lot of times. I mean, it's a very, like, you're good at it. There's so few people that I actually enjoy it. A lot of times it's like, well, what do you do? Here's my joke about construction or what. I don't know.
I was a firefighter. I have a joke about construction.
and I saw him perform and I laughed so hard. It was just incredible. And then 2 days later, I saw him again. He didn't repeat a single thing. It was completely improvised again. And I was in that show. I was laughing so hard. I would leave the room and then think about quitting comedy and then walk back in, laugh very hard some more, leave the room, think about quitting comedy. I did that like 3 or 4 times. I told him that I did this as well. He's just like, but that's also like, you know, it's an appreciation for something that I don't have, and I don't have an interest in curating or doing. But so it's, to me, it's just like, that's pure magic. How in the world could you? It's like watching someone play guitar. I'm like, I don't even understand. Well, it's like, I've never picked up a guitar to like even try to learn.
Nobody can do that. I mean, Rory is magical. And I saw him in 2006, you know, so I've been doing comedy like 4 years. And that was like, it was the first time that I had like 5 minutes that I'm like, these are good. I remember doing a set at the studio, and like Joe List was there, and he, you know, we started out around the same time. And I remember him seeing me and being like, oh, like that was like really good, like in a way that was surprised, because he's like, I've literally never seen you tell that many good jokes in a row before. And I like, not an insult. And I was like, thank you. Like I've been working on it. I've been, you know, working. I've been writing thousands of jokes and figuring it out. And so I did my, you know, we're in the Seattle Comedy Competition in 2006, and 16 people in the first week and 16 people in the second week do their 5-minute set. And almost everybody does the exact same set every night for 6 nights in a row for different audiences, for different judges. And then they add up your best scores and I think drop the lowest, drop the highest and see who moves on. And I saw Rory is one of the people who just did something different every time, like some of the same jokes, but in a different order. He like, and I was like, I didn't know you could do that. Like I had learned from the Boston write a joke, tell a joke school of comedy, you know, like Stephen Wright writes joke symphonies, you know, Gary Goleman writes these curated masterpieces, Wendy Liebman, like beautiful, perfect, honed, curated one liners. And I'm like, oh, I guess that's what I naturally gravitated towards. I'm like, I'll write these little joke equations. I loved Hedberg, you know, and
I love a good structure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then seeing Rory do, like, clearly he had some jokes that were structured, but then it was not that he didn't care about them, but he cared just as much about unstructure.
His most structured jokes are typically my least favorite of, like, not that I don't like those as well, but his ability to just create, to go through a room and start building a story of just various things happening in the room and turn it into like a movie that's happening or so. It's just insane.
Oh, yeah. And then meeting Micah when he moved to Boston and we started being on shows together and then working together and just seeing him also be able to make very funny jokes that were written and he could tell over and over and he got sick of and was just so much, you know, more alive when he was, you know, riffing or improvising or creating something with an interaction with the crowd or the room or being present, you know. And so I was like, I think I can do my own version of that. And like, literally, there's just like one joke that was in my notebook that somebody looked at once and was like, why don't you tell that joke? And I'm like, oh, it didn't work. And they're like, but it's funny. And I'm like, I brought it back and I tried just continuing to talk to that and it didn't work. But I kept talking about it and about the topic and why I thought it was funny. And then I stumbled onto something that people laughed at. And I'm like, oh, I guess I just wasn't done yet. I like the writing was only part of it. And so like now I don't even consider it writing on stage. I'm just like, part of doing comedy is now like having an idea, having something at least that I think is funny. And then being like, but I don't know. I think it would be obnoxious or like presumptuous to know to think that I know now more than future me knows later. Like future me knows everything that I know now and more. He knows what's happening in the room. He knows what's happening in his brain. Then when people are like, what do you think you're going to be like in 5 years? What's your life going to be like? I don't like, I had looked back 5 years ago and I'm like, you have any idea how many things are different now from 5 years ago? Like, I didn't predict all the pandemic material I'd have, for example. And like 5 years ago, nobody was doing pandemic material, let alone me. So that I shifted and that I really, you know, that was how I changed how I started doing comedy. And then my first couple albums, like that I put out in like 2010 and 2013, maybe, like they were just like the best jokes that I'd ever written, you know? And I'm like, and the first album, like, here's the best jokes in an order that I can remember, you know, like no major through line or major, you know, there were some themes that I was like some jokes about being vegan, some jokes about like my life and my relationship, but not like mindful or purposeful. I'm like, whatever people laugh at, that's going in, you know, you laugh at it the most, you got it. I like to think at the beginning of my comedy career, I was more like asking jokes at first than telling jokes. I'm like, is this a joke? And people were like, yes. Then I'm like, all right, I'll tell other people that joke that I asked you about. And eventually with my third album, which was my special Small Dork and Handsome, that was the first time that I structured something in a way that I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to start like this and end like this. And it can't just be in any order. And there's like, then like moving forward, then I started being like, I wonder if I could write a whole show about one thing, you know, like, you know, people would always ask me, like, they see Mike Birbiglia and be like, are you, do you want to do something like that? And I'm like, I'd love to, but I don't know how he does that. Like, I can't, like, I don't think of one big idea and then fill it. I think of a billion little things and then create a big thing out of it.
Yeah.
And, but then I was dating a woman who wanted kids and I didn't want kids. And I was writing a lot of material about not wanting kids. And I was like, well, maybe if I just keep doing it instead of like waiting for the muse to strike, you know, just being like, well, I think I get to decide what I write. I don't just wait for my brain to think of things. I, not my brain. Me, which is my brain and other parts of me, maybe. Brain and heart and fingers. Fingers get involved. And my eyes and my all my senses. And, you know, so I was like, it used to be really, I was kind of not, I didn't know that I was taking the easy way. And it didn't feel like it was the easy way. But I wasn't. Maybe like with a relationship, I was, you know, with relationships, after it stopped being fun, after it stopped being easy, after a year, I had so many relationships that didn't last more than a year because it got hard. And I was like, well, guess it's not working. And like with so many jokes, I'm like, well, that's as far as that one goes. I guess I'll move on to this topic. But so that was like, you know, maybe 10 years ago that I was like, oh, maybe I'll stick to this topic. Maybe I'll put, but I think this topic is important and it's meaningful to me and I can grow more things out of it. And that is what I started doing at that point. And so put out that album. And then I'm like, well, that's most of, I'm like, I can just do that every time now, like pick one important thing that I want to talk about. Like right now, the hour that I'll record next, you know, that I'll hope to do as a special or an album in the next year that I'm aiming to take it to Edinburgh this year. Is all about my relationship with my girlfriend. And then I have an hour brewing that's about my grandmother who just died a couple years ago, and an hour brewing about my relationship with masculinity, and an hour brewing about Buddhism. And like maybe some of these will go together and maybe they won't all manifest the way that they do. And also all the jokes that don't fit with them, I still write and enjoy writing and enjoy telling, like whatever's meaningful or like important in the moment, I'll talk about. But also, I've started releasing albums or recording albums every once in a while that I just call live in between albums. And those ones don't have any themes. They don't have to have. I'm just like, these are all the jokes that didn't fit in any of the major themes, because I do still want, like, I want to honor them and I want to share them and be like, this is fun. And even though it doesn't have anything to do with my grandmother, audiences deserve to know this stupid thought I had about Don Rickles, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, mine originated from when, once I started wanting to like integrate science and bigger ideas into my act, it was just the setups got to be too long for a payoff unless I kept on adding to that payoff. And then I was like, well, the way to do this is to create a theme and just keep on building. So that first part, you know, it might not be the most laugh heavy aspect. Instead, you know, originally it was like, hey, you got 5 minutes on late night. You get a laugh within the first 10 seconds and boom, 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 boom. And instead just starting slower and building and setting up something and really exploring it, creating a lens that then the audience can look through life at with you through that new lens, and making jokes based on that lens has been something that like really appealed to me.
Yeah. You know, that's beautiful. And also, do you know this Lenny Bruce quote? He once said, I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
And that's like a perfect, I think, encapsulation of, you know, the goal. There's this thing from the Talmud that's like also, you know, there's a Rabbi Zusha who says to his students, he says, when I die, I don't fear that God will judge me by saying, why were you not more like Moses? Why were you not more like Abraham? He says, I fear that God will judge me by saying, why were you not more like Zusha? Yeah. And so that's the point, is that we should all be like Zusha.
Yeah.
We should all be, you know, ourselves, that we should all figure out, like, you know, if you look at Bo Burnham and you're like, well, where's the punchline in the first line of his stand-up? Oh, that's not what he's doing at all. If you look at Reggie Watts or Tim Minchin, like, I mean, I love or Henry Phillips, who is also, you know, capable of and often does deliver like beautiful, succinct, like perfect one-line jokes. And then also sometimes it's just like, here's a song, you know, a beautiful song that's played well, that makes you feel things in addition to the hilarious stuff that's going on. Like, I was on an edible the other night, and a thing that I really like doing on edibles is listening to music, and specifically music videos. Like, and when music, I watched Jack Black, those guys, Tenacious D. Like, I watched a Tenacious D video that I hadn't seen, and I'm like, they're good at music and they're funny. And I'm like, what's better than both of those things? Like, musical comedy gets such a bad rap sometimes, but like, for the masters of it, I'm like, it's so magical that you can, I mean, just they're being themselves. They're doing a thing. Like, if I feel like it's an honor to be able, if somebody's like, who are they like? What is that like? To be like, I don't know. Like, they're like them. Like, they're the comparison by which other people are like, oh, you're kind of doing a thing like that. And like, that's way better than being like, you know, better to be the special event that people are coming to see because they know exactly who you are and they're not sad that you didn't tell one punchline 10 seconds in, but they're waiting for, you know, 2 hours to get the whole download.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm excited to see how the new Mind Under Matter 2.0 evolves, because there's basically we've all had so much going on that the only way that I could keep doing the show is if I like also use it to help explore some of the other things that I'm putting together with like the Vegas show and everything else, just because things are just intensely busy right now. And so I might reach back out to you again soon. Maybe people can, because of this was in some emails, I was like, hey, do you want to get together and write like the old days?
Sure.
And maybe we can just do that on the show sometime. I can go through like the outline of my show and stuff. We can brainstorm some topics. That could be really fun.
In the spirit of the day that this is coming out, I'd love it.
Oh, and I have the person that created and animated Tales, Comedy Central's Tales from the Trip, that I've been on a bunch. He's going to be joining the show coming up, and I have some other the artists, like the digital artist VJ, that's helping me build the show that I might have on as well. And then I might have some psychedelic researchers on Here We Are, and I kind of have to like get everything like very integrated and working together over the next couple months, so that might be fun. But I might reach out to like Rory Scovel and Micah Sherman as well, since they got plugs on the show, and let it just be like an organic thing that builds in a way that that just feels natural.
I love it.
So where can people find all of your stuff? Your you and I used to be the two most prolific comedians in Boston, I would say. And then I started not caring as much about that and focusing on like production and marketing and like other like building things and stuff more. And so you have gone on to become even that much more prolific. You have so many things people can check out, watch, listen to. Where should they go?
Thank you. That's quite the kind invitation. So Mike Kaplan, spelled the weird way I spell it, MYQKAPLAN. That's something that you can put into anywhere, MikeKaplan.com. I have a bunch of albums on the streaming platforms. The most recent one's called AKA. There's some one that, at least that plays exclusively on Sirius satellite radio. So if you listen to like Laugh USA, you can hear me there. I tell people about my shows in a newsletter that I send out every week, and I also put out jokes with that, and it's called Arty Har Hars. That's at mikekaplan.substack.com. I've got a couple podcasts, at least, two that I do myself, one Broccoli and Ice Cream that you've been a guest on, Shane, where I have conversations with people about the work of that they do in their life and the joys of their life. And then I have one called The Faucet, where it's basically like this, but without Shane, just me talking. And then I just started a new, I'm a voice actor in a new adventure podcast called IntraQuest. I am one of the leads, and then the other two are Mike Leibovitz and Matthew Broussard. We're like, it's kind of like a space adventure, and it just started launching, and it'll be coming out from iHeartRadio, all the places podcasts are, once a week. And yeah, my podcasts, my albums, my social media is just at Mike Kaplan, and you can write me messages and I'll get them and probably write you back. So thanks. And it's a pleasure to know you. I love
pleasure to know you
and your work. I'm excited. I love Ramin. And also I love when Ramin's here on this show. And I also love when Ramin's not here so that I can be here. So thank you, Ramin. And thank you, Shane, for having me.
Well, another thing, because we're figuring out what to do with Patreon bonus content. And the same thing is like, I think that I'm going to have to hash out like this show that I'm putting together and give people a little more of an insight. Maybe you and I could do a bonus Patreon episode at some point too, where I could just share with you some things that may not be like as entertaining for a public episode, but really entertaining as like a super fan really wanting to know about the ins and outs of like, I have a marketing video and thing that I'm putting together that I have to write stuff for that you might be able to help me with.
Sounds great.
Yeah, this is cool. This is a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And until next time, keep on salivating, honeys. I hope you enjoyed the first me doing having another guest on Mind Under Matter. A couple updates just since this episode was recorded. One, I'm going to play a little bit of Mike Kaplan's music just because it's fun to immerse some of our guests' art and things in the show. Two, I've been connecting with Ramin on what's going on with the show. Sounds very likely he's going to be coming back much sooner rather than later, but he's also just going through some stuff right now. We're going through stuff. The world's going through stuff. The whole MUM universe is shifting a little bit, but I think he will be back very soon. I've already confirmed Micah Sherman and Rory Scovel, who were who are mentioned on this show to come on as sort of a natural progression of things. But I also have reached out to Pete Holmes and the founder of Meow Wolf, that is the partner with Area 15 in Vegas that I'm working. He's going to be coming on, and then the founder of Omega Mart, which is part of Meow Wolf, and one of the co-founders of Meow Wolf, is also either she's going to be joining him or going to be coming on solo. I have a musician or two that I'm starting to potentially work with on a few different aspects of the Vegas show. We might be changing up the theme song here, waiting to hear back from till things settle down in Ramin's life a little bit. I'm recording this after having just recorded a bonus episode with Mike Kaplan. We shot the shit for a little bit and then got into some of the where I'm at with putting together the Vegas show, which was actually a pretty fun conversation, but different than a public episode and more like very behind the scenes-y kind of, you know, for for you super fans that want to know more of the stuff that I'm kind of not broadcasting publicly and the ins and outs of all of the stuff that I'm putting together for this crazy big show that I'm very excited about. So a lot of cool stuff happening. And so if any of you were at all like a little disappointed that the show is changing in any way, I don't think that you will be for long. It is expanding. It isn't just going to be me and Ramin anymore. It will be that. And in addition, it will be lots of other things as well. It's going to open up a lot of bandwidth for both of us, which will get us reinvigorated and give us a lot more energy and enthusiasm for this show. So thank you guys for hanging, especially all the Patreon supporters that hung in there through the long delay of just a couple months of just absolute madness behind the scenes. And just not just with the show, just personal life and all sorts of, not just me and Ramin either, a lot of different crazy things going on. It just all happened at once. And so thank you for sticking with us. And I am very confident that this show is going to be better than ever and Mind Under Matter 2.0. Minds Under Matters. So enjoy some bonus content, and probably next week you will be seeing the creator of Comedy Central's Tales from the Trip on the show. We're definitely recording, and he's working with me on the Vegas show, but if Ramin ends up popping on or something like that between now and then it will be Ramin and I, but it's Mum's going to be a bit of a mystery for the next month or so. Awesome. Thank you guys so much.